Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I actually got an email this morning from somebody in Great Britain who was annoyed at my newsletter saying Happy Wednesday. I guess, you know, because for some reason he thought that this was enraging. So I wrote back to him and said, hey, thanks for your email, and please do have a Happy Wednesday. And he unsubscribed from my newsletter, which is an indication that maybe people are a little bit on edge. And you can certainly understand that given what's going on, the number of coronavirus cases and the absolutely stunning jobs numbers we got this morning. We talked about this with Ben White from Politico yesterday, who was walking through the various scenarios of what could happen to the economy. And we were talking about what those job numbers might look like. And there was a consensus that maybe there would be something like 3.5 million people who had successfully filed for unemployment, which would equal what we saw last week, which blew away all records. In fact, it was exponentially worse than any of those projections. 6.6 million Americans successfully filing for unemployment. That is 10 million in just 2 weeks. And we have the sense that things are not going to get better. So I guess we could start off with saying happy Thursday. Joining me on the podcast once again, David Frum from The Atlantic Magazine. David, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. I appreciate it.
It's so good to connect.
All right. I want to read to you something that you wrote back in July of last year, 2019. You wrote, when this is all over, nobody will admit to ever supporting it.
Well, we've had in the past 2 weeks an appetizer serving of that truth. Look at how not only have defenders of the president pivoted to say that he did take the coronavirus seriously, that he never called it a flu. They are now outraged when anyone reminds them of what they were saying only 6 weeks ago. Donald Trump, in fact, has tried to bring legal action against an advertiser who quoted him describing coronavirus as the Democrats' new hoax. I never said that, he says. Well, of course, he did say it. There's going to be a reinvention of the past. And as this crisis plays through the country, as it takes its terrible toll in life and suffering, as it takes its terrible economic toll, I think we are on our way to seeing Donald Trump leave office, one of the most execrated presidents in American history. And as he does, the people who supported him will then begin to explain, well, I was never for Trump. I was against the media's unfairness. I was against media bias. You know, I never liked his spending. Obviously, he was never a true conservative. And all that evidence you have of me defending him, you know, it's kind of hateful of you to bring that up. That is where we are going. We've had a little appetizer in the past few days. More to come.
We are seeing this extraordinary attempt at revising history, and I think we're going to see a lot more between now and November. But a lot of it still seems to at least in Trump world, the revision of what he did and said. And I'm still seeing people saying we still support Donald Trump despite all of this evidence. It will be a stress test, not just for the democracy as a whole, but very much for these Trump defenders who've managed to defend and rationalize almost everything. And at least at the moment, they seem poised to do it again, including, and I'm not going to name names, but I mean, people who, you know, you and I have read and followed for years, who have been very, very critical of Trump. In fact, maybe at one point were never Trump, who are still basically saying, no, it's not fair to criticize the president. He did everything he could. This is the revisionist history. You're trying to evaluate him on hindsight. It's all the Chinese. So I'm still not seeing people breaking from Trump yet.
Well, let me read you something from Hannah Arendt that I think applies very strongly to this case. She wrote, lies, by their very nature, have to be changed. And a lying government has constantly to rewrite its own history. On the receiving end, you get not only one lie, a lie which you could go on for the rest of your days, but you get a great number of lies depending on how the political wind blows. And that's what is going on now, is that the you had to believe one set of lies. To be a Trump supporter in good standing, you had to believe a certain set of lies in January and a different set of lies in February and a different set of lies again before March 13th. And then a new set of lies between March 13th and this past weekend. And now one more new set of lies. And there will be, by the time we're done, there will be more new lies still to come. I compared the Fox News pivot over the weekend of March 13th to the Daily Worker on June 22nd, 1941. If you went to bed on the night of June 21st, 1941, as a reader of the Daily Worker, you were told that the war between Great Britain on the one side and the Soviet Union on the other, Nazi Germany on the other, mm-hmm. was an imperialist war from which the United States must stay neutral. And then you woke up the next morning and it was now no longer an imperialist war, but now a war between democracy and fascism, and the United States must enter as soon as possible. And American communists adapted themselves to that whipsaw. And Fox viewers have had to adapt themselves to this, a very similar whipsaw. And they are struggling for ways to make sense of it. As you say, the attempt to make this a story about China, not about the American reaction to China, is part of it. There will be more.
So since we're quoting Hannah Arendt, let me give you another one where she's also talking about this, the use of lies. She says the totalitarian mass leaders base their propaganda on the correct psychological assumption that under such conditions, one could make people believe the most fantastic statements one day and trust that if the next day they were given irrefutable proof of their falsehood, they would mm-hmm. take refuge in cynicism. Instead of deserting the leaders who had lied to them, they would protest they'd known all along that the statement was a lie and would admire the leaders for their superior tactical cleverness.
Oh, that's very
isn't that good? That's sort of like Rush Limbaugh, who will go, "See, I never believed that, and this was just Trump trolling the libs," and people go along with that.
Trolling the libs. Let me stress: I have never thought of Donald Trump as at the deepest level an authoritarian or autocratic leader. My theme about the Trump presidency from the beginning was that the thing you needed to understand about Donald Trump was that he was fundamentally a crook, that he didn't have political ideas. Where the attack on institutions came from in Trump's case is he's not like Viktor Orban. You know, Viktor Orban has a vision of power, of what he wants to do with it, and then he is, with remorseless intent and consistency and cunning, degraded Hungarian institutions to the point where he could seize power when he was given his opportunity with this virus. That's not Trump. Trump is lazy and crooked. Trump's problem is he's not a very good crook, and his criminality is not very well hidden. And so he's in constant legal danger. And the result is he has to attack the law, whereas Orban is attacking the law, as it were, offensively, with a vision of where he wants to go. Trump is attacking the law defensively to protect himself. And that's also the nature of Trump's lies. Trump is lying not with some calculated political scheme, like Hannah Arendt's authoritarian leader, totalitarian leaders. He lies because there's no past or future for him. He lives entirely in the moment, and he's about the defense of his ego. So I think for the 25% of America that is strongly invested in Trump, and for the additional 20 to 25 points, or taking us up to 45% that is mildly invested in him, I think the comparison to their stake in Trump and the background to the quote you read at the beginning, but no one will admit it's over. Mm-hmm. Is not those nightmare regimes in the middle of the 20th century. It's actually, and I hope no one has had a friend in this situation, but I have, a friend who gets caught up with some scam, timeshare, mm-hmm. something like that. And what happens is the friend believes the scam and believes in a whole way of life and believes in the seller. And when you try to help, the friend gets angry at you because you're attacking you.
Yeah.
And later, when the whole thing comes crashing down and your friend loses his money and he can no longer deny that you are right, he will never forgive you. Mm-hmm. He will forgive the crook, but he will never forgive the people who warned him against the crook. The crook just took his money. You made him feel dumb. And I think that is a little bit what's going on in Trump world. I think there is, and one of the reasons for the increasing hysteria that you see on talk radio and Fox News is they are bracing themselves for the accusation that you lie to people, you deceive people. And what we're seeing here is the beginning of a group, a tribal ego defense.
You can feel that decibel level rising. When you talk about the hysteria, I mean, I picked up on this about 2 weeks ago, that it was becoming more shrill, a little bit more hysterical, lashing out. And I think you described the psychology behind it absolutely perfectly, because this is going to be a very, very difficult moment for them going forward. So let me just talk about, get your sense of this moment, because we have been talking about this quote unquote pivot, where the president comes out and many members of the media said, well, this is a, you know, he gets it now. He's now listening to the science. This is a much more somber approach. And from the moment that he did, quote unquote, get it, it is interesting, isn't it, watching some of these red state governors who have resisted taking steps, now basically taking their guidance once again from Donald Trump and saying, well, you know, if the president says that it's okay, we're going to shut down Florida, we're going to shut down Georgia, we're going to shut down Texas, we're going to shut down Mississippi. So give me some sense of this pivot that's taking place right now.
Well, someone who I believe has been a guest of yours on the show, Mike Murphy, had a line in 2016. I looked it up the other day. I had to source it on Twitter. I couldn't Google it, but somebody kindly found it for me. He said in 2016, on the eve of the Republican convention in Cleveland, teaching Donald Trump to sound presidential is like teaching Charles Manson to foxtrot. He can certainly execute a step or two, but then he will stab you in the eye because he's Charles Manson. And I think it's with Trump, you can get him to act presidential for a moment. And look, there is some real use, because some of these red state governors, Governor DeSantis in Florida is not a fool. He's a coward and a weakling, but he's not a fool. And he was balancing his political permissions as he decided how to respond to the problem in Florida. Same thing with Governor Abbott in Texas. I think the governor of Oklahoma is a fool, Governor Stitt, but the failing governors have been trapped, that they have important local business interests, and they have a public opinion that has been shaped by the permission structure created by President Trump and Fox News. So now they're allowed to take it seriously. And we have to hope and pray. And if you haven't developed the habit of praying in your life yet, I strongly advise it now. You have to hope and pray that it's not too late for these states, and that what is coming in, because these red states, although they have weaker public institutions and weaker healthcare systems, they also do have the advantage of having more distributed populations, less population density, except for Texas. And I think people do overlook how urbanized a state Texas is. And when this begins to spread in places like Houston and Dallas, that impact can be devastating. Florida is also, although very suburban and exurban, also is a highly urbanized state.
You described this shift in position from Trump going from being AWOL and then panic, and the way that it played out state by state. And I do think that, and I've made this point on the podcast the last couple of days, there's going to be a lag time here, you know, particularly when you have these major states that in fact we're taking the signal from the AWOL Donald Trump, and now suddenly have to switch everything into the panic mode.
And the panic is going to be very difficult to execute, because the kernel of truth in what Donald Trump says about the states is the United States does rely on states to deliver public health. They have the bureaucracies, they control the people. But there is an essential coordinating function that the federal government has to do. So states, for example, don't end up bidding against each other for same supplies. And so federal stockpiles are intelligently allocated. And the problem with all of that is one of the things Donald Trump did to make the country unready for this pandemic was he hollowed out the assistant secretary and deputy assistant secretary level of the government. Either the jobs are unfilled, or they're filled by worthless people, or they're filled by people who, if they're not Dr. Redfield, who heads the CDC, I mean, he does have some credentials, but Donald Trump did not choose the best person for the job. he looked through a list of people who were acceptable to religious right, and found of the people who were acceptable to the religious right, which one of them was the best doctor, and hence Dr. Redfield. There are better people to have, but he was the one who was politically acceptable. So even when you panic and say, okay, now let's make this all work, let's talk to the states, what you found is that the levers of power are all broken. The levers of communication are all broken. And Donald Trump, there's a real problem with public trust. Let me give you one concrete example of this. There's a story, I now forget whether it was in the New York Times or not, about how the federal emergency stockpile is being allocated more to red states where the virus is new than to the big cities. This is not necessarily an insane decision, any more than Mike Pompeo's decision to send a lot of aid to China early on was necessarily an insane decision. I mean, you do want to stop this thing before it gets going. There's a defensible case, or there could have been in advance a defensible case. Let's send our troops to the front line, not to defend our own cities, fight over there so we don't have to fight over here, and try to stop it in Wuhan. But when you do that strategy, and if it fails, as the attempt to head it off at Wuhan fails, you need a level of social trust that people understand, okay, you did this for good motives, not for crass political motives. And there is no trust. And Donald Trump's obvious indifference to the suffering of New York and California, and on Fox, many of us were their glee in the suffering of New York and California. Yeah. Dinesh D'Souza, chuckling over it on Fox News on the Laura Ingraham program. Then you say to blue state people or big city people, trust us that we are allocating this equipment to the red states, not out of malice to you, but because it's medically necessary. How can they possibly believe it, even should it be true?
And this, of course, is something that we had warned about, or that many people had warned about, the reason why the president's lies would ultimately matter, that there comes a moment when your credibility is important, when it is crucial for the government to be believed when it makes a statement. And this is one of them. So earlier today, there was an interesting moment, I thought, where it was within the same, and you retweeted Philip Rucker from the Washington Post making this point, that in the exact same hour that we found out that 10 million Americans have filed for unemployment in the last 2 weeks, Trump lashed out at Chuck Schumer. Apparently he was watching him on Morning Joe, blaming New York for getting off to a late start, just sort of lashing out. Somebody please explain to crying Chuck Schumer that we do have a military man in charge and blah, 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 blah. It was, again, one of these moments where the gap between what you would hope for from a president at a time of crisis and the behavior of this president, it was stark. It's not the first time, but maybe it's just the magnitude, people dying in New York, 10 million Americans out of work. And the president of the United States is sitting there and he is tweeting about crying Chuck Schumer.
Well, there's a bargain that every president makes with his political opposition, which goes something like this. I, the president, will in public be decorous and restrained. Whatever I say in the family quarters to my loved ones or to my more intimate aides, however much I yell at the TV, however unfair I think the media is, when I go out, I act decorously, because there will be a moment when I will need to make people think, this is not President Barack Obama. This is President Barack Obama. This is not President George W. Bush. This is President George W. Bush. I want you to forget about me, the individual who holds the office, and pay attention to the office. So Donald Trump will ask for his side of that bargain at regular intervals. Why don't people give deference to the president? Why don't people show me respect? Why don't people believe what I say when I speak from the Oval Office? And the answer is, well, you didn't uphold your side of the bargain. If you behave in the Oval Office from all the institutions of ceremony and power of the United States, like the terrible individual person you are, you can't then turn off my memory of that. So when you say, why can't we all rally around our president? Well, if you're going to scream at Chuck Schumer, then you're just a hack politician. And one who's, by the way, way less public-spirited and intelligent than Chuck Schumer. But just qua human being, obviously Chuck Schumer, for all his many, many faults, if we're judging person to person, of course, any thoughtful person would rely on Chuck Schumer ahead of Donald Trump. like you'd rely on a lot of people in state prison ahead of Donald Trump. So he wants the office, but he won't do his part. And now we are all suffering for it because, you know, in an important way, the country is going through this crisis. It's with only half a government and without really a president. I may have missed something. I don't want to be unfair, but as far as I can tell, I haven't been watching every minute of these press conferences. I don't think I've ever heard from Donald Trump's lips a word of compassion for any of the now nearing 5,000 Americans who have died and the hundreds of thousands of Americans who have suffered. And I think it's not in him. He also is aware that many of us think that the toll would be less if he had behaved better. But that lack of, if you're not going to be the mourner in chief, and he's never done that, then you don't get the benefit of the public deference that comes from fulfilling the head of state role.
So a couple of hours, you tweeted out a story about Ronald Reagan in his declining years. Oh. That they actually showed him old photos to
this
try to know to
my spark, heart.
Yeah, just to spark his faded memory. And you said that Reagan responded as they're showing him these pictures to try to get him to remember, that he said, "It's like I was never president at all."
Yeah.
And then you link that to where we're at now.
I couldn't lay hands in time on the source of that story, so I couldn't say who the visitor was. I have a feeling it was James Baker, but that's only a feeling. But Reagan at that point had lucid moments where he was wrong. He was himself in the moment, but he had no memory of the past. And so they were showing him these things. And so he understood at that moment what it was to be president, but he couldn't remember that he had ever been that person.
Wow.
And and that terribly poignant line, it was as if I was never president at all. But Trump, I mean, when he calls on the governor of New York to do something, he's just like another person in the nursing home. You know, how many old people are looking at the TV and say, the governor of New York should do this or that? Well, you're the president of the United States. If you think the governor of New York should do something that he's not doing, he'll take your call.
Yeah.
Call him. Tell him what you think he should do. But when you're yelling at the TV, what Trump does is he endlessly exposes his powerlessness and his hatred of responsibility. And I think one of the things that the book I published in 2018, and again, the book I'm publishing in 2020, one of the things I've argued against in everything I've written about Donald Trump is the theory of Donald Trump as incipient fascist dictator.
Mm-hmm.
Trump is Hitler. I've had a joke about this, that there are many stops on the train line of bad before you get to Hitler station. Mm-hmm. But it's also important to realize that not all bad people are bad in the same way. And Trump, because he doesn't have political ideas, because he is fundamentally a crook, and because he's a lazy crook, he's not arrogating power unto himself. And he also, because he complains so much, he looks weak. And I think that is going to be, in the coming weeks, a greater and greater feature of this presidency. That, you know, the American president as a legal institution is a powerful office, but it's not like the prime minister of Great Britain. Within the context of the British political system, the prime minister has much more power than an American president does. What an American president has that no other democratic leader has is authority. There's a story that Hank Paulson tells in his memoir he got a call from the White House to come meet with George W. Bush in 2007 or thereabouts. And he tried to avoid the meeting. And he postponed it. He made difficulties because he knew that Bush was going to ask him to be Treasury Secretary, a job Paulson desperately wanted not to accept. And Paulson also knew that if you're an American and you're in the Oval Office and the president looks you in the eye and asks you to do something, you must say yes. You cannot say no to the president. But people say no to the Prime Minister of Great Britain all the time. People say no because, I don't want to do it. No, thanks. Bill, Bob, Fred, Maggie, no. No one says, Mr. President, the answer is no, except maybe the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the Senate Majority Leader, but a private citizen doesn't because of the tremendous authority of that office. But Trump has wanted has sort of grabbed for power when he remembers it, but he's dribbled away the authority. And that's going to come home to haunt him, that as he looks weaker, as the economy does not respond, as the virus does not go away because he tweets angrily at it, he's going to find that not only is power leaving his hands, but authority is gone, and he doesn't have instrumentalities anymore, And I think what we're going to see, back to the quote you read at the beginning, is the dribbling away. And as people get sick in the area, in the Trump heartland, as they realize there isn't equipment for them, and as the economy stays terrible for a long time, I think we're going to have this crumbling away.
Well, also, yeah, I was looking at some poll numbers out of my home state of Wisconsin, where his approval rating has been relatively steady. But you look at some of the crosstabs, and people are still very optimistic about the economy. So how will that age? What will people say about that in September? So you're talking about the authority of the presidency. This also, though, that's also relates to our role as a global leader, doesn't it? Is that the world looks to us for as an example, as an exemplar. Ronald Reagan talked about the shining city on the hill. Other presidents have been very, very careful to make sure that they preserve America's position in the world. Where are we at now? What is our status?
That is something I worry about so, so much. I was born in Canada, and I'm still very involved in Canadian life. I have a house there. And I think sometimes one of the things that, from my background, I bring to my understanding of American politics is what it has meant for the Cold War era to live under that big, generous umbrella of American power. And I don't want to exaggerate it or be naive. I mean, power is never used innocently in this guilty world. And the United States has many mistakes on its conscience and many misdeeds and some crimes. But on balance, it's been the world after World War II was not only better ordered than ever before in history, but on its way constantly to better and better order than that. And after 1989 and 1990, we really had a vision of a global order backed by U.S. power, but not by the United States alone, but in concert. The United States always led with consent. It was not an empire. It was the leader of a confederation of other wealthy and powerful states. And that was a tremendous force multiplier for the United States. Now, your allies, the price of it was the allies didn't always agree. And there are important and agonizing disagreements at many, many points. But in the end, there was always that sense of when there was a real problem, the United States would step up and it would pay a disproportionate share of the cost and money and treasure. And in return, it would have a disproportionate share of the command about what was to be done. And everybody welcomed that. This is the thing that is maybe one of the most enduring legacies of Donald Trump, the end of that. Because Trump can't think in those terms. He is isolated, paranoid, and predatory. And he's remade American policy in his own image. And so there was a story today about the French regional government had ordered some supplies in China. American officials appeared on the tarmac and produced a wad of cash and essentially outbid or bribed the supplies for the United States. Well, just as the federal government should be coordinating among the states and heading off a scramble, so there should be a mechanism where the United States and its NATO partners and other close non-NATO partners like Japan and Taiwan, Australia, have some kind of coordination, and states will be somewhat selfish, but they can be less selfish. Now we've just got a scramble of all against all, and the United States looks so untrustworthy, so selfish. That story, many people who listen to this podcast may remember or maybe have forgotten, but the United States trying to buy Germany's leading vaccine maker. Americans have forgotten that story. Germans have not. And the claim that Trump wanted the vaccine for the United States first and others second, and maybe that's exaggerated in some way, but it's believed in Germany. And this story about the airline crew will be remembered in France. And what we are watching here is the unraveling of the Western alliance. One last thing about this point. One of the things the Trump defenders are saying now is we need to spend a lot of time blaming China. Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to be central to their strategy going forward.
Right. The problem is Donald Trump keeps undercutting the strategy by tweeting positively about President Xi. My joke is that a normal president would say, our serious differences with the Chinese authorities in no way license expression of racial animus against people of Chinese descent. whereas the Trump point of view seems to be, are expressions of racial animus against people of Chinese descent in no way are criticisms of the Chinese authorities. We love President Xi. It's just the Chinese Americans we hate. But here's the problem with that. Of course, if you believe that China is a problem, and I do, and if you believe that the Chinese state cannot be trusted, then you need to stand up other international institutions. But you know, the United States, because so many of these viruses originate in China, the United States used to maintain a Centers for Disease Control office inside China to be America's own eyes and ears inside China, and other governments did the same thing. And there was coordination, the British and the United States and the French and the Germans and the Canadians and the Australians, we all sort of shared it. We had kind of the Japanese, I assume, I don't know. We understood China's a problem. You have to work around them to a little bit. The Donald Trump people, for crass budget reasons, cut that office, the CDC office in China, by 2/3.
Yeah. So draining the swamp, right?
Right. So the reason that the United States was so dependent on the World Health Organization for information about what was going on inside of China, that was related to Donald Trump's own unwillingness to work cooperatively with other people. And the World Health Organization, it's part of the UN system, and so it has all the problems of the UN, which is excessive deference to the sovereignty of authoritarian states. The Chinese economy, China as a country, is now nearly as powerful as the United States. The United States alone cannot control, the United States can obviously resist China, but it cannot constrain China's behavior, cannot make China a better partner. But the United States plus friends can. The United States plus the EU plus Japan plus the other TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership nations, that's a bloc with an economy three times the size of China's. That bloc could impose rules on China. When you say we're not going to cooperate, we're no longer globalists, we're not going to have partners, then the United States is alone in the room with China, and China can say, blow it out your ear.
You know, you think back on the last 3 years, which seems so traumatic, and right now, I just have this gut. It feels frivolous. Like we were engaging in reality TV show. He would be able to describe the hollowing out of government as draining the swamp. And I think a lot of Americans sort of regarded it as, well, that's just Donald Trump being Donald Trump. And now suddenly it's real. And which is why I do think this is going to be different. But a lot of the things that he said and did were that only a country incredibly confident and prosperous would do. I mean, only a country that was, I think, profoundly unserious would say, let's put Donald Trump in the Oval Office, kind of a luxury lark for someone to do, to say, let's burn it all down. And now we're seeing, you know, is Donald Trump going to stand up and say, yes, I slashed government employment because I wanted to drain the swamp? Going to be able to say, you know, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Are you going to say, no, well, you know, check your 401k? I mean, all of those things that he would have been able to say and that would have played a few months ago, they're all gone now, aren't they?
Well, this has to be answered subjectively. So I can only answer from my own perspective. It has never felt frivolous to me. I remember.
Nor to me. No.
Yeah. But no, I'm not. But I just, like, I have felt, I remember calling the night of the election in 2016. I was in Toronto. I was doing a live commentary for the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. So I was in a studio in Toronto. And because the election night went on so late, basically we ran out of reporters. And so, you know, it was on one of those things where you're on for, you know, 10 minutes in the 8 o'clock hour and 10 minutes in the 9 o'clock hour and 10 minutes in the 10 o'clock hour. And then suddenly it's you and the anchor until 3 a.m. it was so upsetting. I remember calling home. There was a break and I was able to call home, and my wife had already fallen asleep, and I got my youngest daughter on the phone. And I had to say to her, I'm just so sorry. We failed you so badly. I don't think the country adopted Trump on a lark. I think what happened was a minority of Americans, for reasons both sympathetic and not, people felt like they had not participated in the prosperity of the previous years, but also people were driven by racial animus. I just don't think we can write that out of the story. They inflicted this on the dynamic part of the country. And, you know, In the book I've got coming out, I compare, you know, I remember hearing, I won't say who, but an important Republican crow after the 2016 election, that the Republicans now had dominance in a way that they had at the federal, state, and local level in a way they hadn't had since the 1920s. And I replied then, I replied in the book, yeah, but in the 1920s, the Republican dominance was based on majorities in all the dynamic parts of the country. In 1924, Calvin Coolidge got 55% of the vote in New York, the financial heartland of the country, 65% of the vote in Pennsylvania, the industrial heartland of the country, and in the state that was the center of the new economy, Michigan, he got 75% of the vote. Today, any place where a product is invented or a song is written or research is done where the future is made, the Republican Party is as dead as the Dixiecrats. They are the Dixiecrats. The Republican Party so had fluked out this national dominance in 20, it was like the it was as if William Jennings Bryan had won. All the most reactionary parts of the country seized power up and down and within states too. So like it's not a red state. It's no longer red states versus blue states. They're parts of North Carolina and Tennessee that are as dynamic as anything in Silicon Valley, but they are surrounded by hinterlands that are not, that are cut off and resentful of the modern world. And through at both the federal and state level, we saw that. And then it proceeded to cannibalize the American state and to cannibalize America's role in the world. And I saw from election night, everything I cherish, and a lot of things I never knew I cherished because I never thought about them as something you needed to cherish. Like, you know, the integrity of the federal government and the special integrity of the presidency, all of those things were under attack. And so when you say we're seeing it now, what we're seeing now is the price. You know, the patient was smoking 3 packs a day for 20 years, and we've just taken an incision into the lung to see what the lung looks like after all those cigarettes. But it's not like the crisis began when we sliced into the lung. The cigarettes were the crisis.
When I mentioned that about how we've changed our, the country is now, you know, encountering this sober price. I'm looking at this quote from Philip Roth that I know you're very familiar with, where he kept describing, you know, the relentless unforeseen, and that this is perhaps something that many Americans have forgotten. And he said, you know, turn the wrong way around, the relentless unforeseen was what we school children studied in history, harmless history, where everything unexpected in its own time is chronicled on the page as inevitable. The terror of the unforeseen is what the science of history hides, turning a disaster into an epic. And I just think that's so haunting, because we think that things are going on in a certain direction. We think there's a certain solidity. We think that there are certain predictions we can make about the future because we look at the past and it looks much more orderly than it was. But the reality is we do live in this, are faced with this relentless unforeseen, which is why you don't do something as imprudent or foolish or outrageous as putting Donald Trump in the Oval Office, why you don't behave in a reckless and irresponsible manner, why you don't put a crook in the position of the leader of the free world, because you don't know what's coming, because it's always going to be something, some moment that's going to test whether or not we're getting it right or not.
That's very well said. I think that's so powerfully true.
So what is the title of your new book?
You know, when the publisher and I agreed on this title, we thought it might be a little overstated. The title is Trumpocalypse.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow.
And I now think it might be a little understated. But I want to say something about this title. I say this at the in the introduction of the book.
That's great.
Which is we use the word apocalypse to mean catastrophe.
Yeah.
Nuclear apocalypse, economic apocalypse. But those people who grew up with the Christian revelations will know that's not exactly what it means. The word apocalypse literally comes from the Greek words to unveil, to remove the covering from something. Mm-hmm. Or another way is an apocalypse is a revelation. So the book of Revelations, the Christian book of Revelations, and the Jewish literature on which it was modeled was based on a vision of the future. And yes, the future contained many disasters, many calamities, many catastrophes. But that was not the end of something. It was the beginning of something. And so this Trumpocalypse is a moment in it, for along with the suffering, it's a moment of revelation. And what I hope is, we never know when it's too late, and we always have to act as if it's not, but that we can reconstitute an effective American government. We can reconstitute American leadership in the world. We can become again the people we used to think we were. We can stand in the eyes of others in the way we think we deserve to. And so that's the book's great theme.
Okay, well, we also have the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, right? Which seem to be like ripped from the headlines: plague, famine, war, death.
Yes. So. Those are all realities, including that we see that through this plague, Secretary of State Pompeo is considering whether this is the right moment for a war with Iran. And I this is one of those moments where, and I'm a pretty hawkish person. I've been pretty hawkish on Iran, but I don't understand the way of thinking that says this moment, you sat down with the secret briefings, maybe I'm wrong, but every instinct in my being would tell me, if I was sitting at the table, this is the moment where you meet the Iran problem with a massive show of generosity, mm-hmm. A show of friendship so powerful that it either works, or at least it isolates the leadership within that country so in such a tiny corner that they will never be able to break out. And that every person in Iran knows the United States wanted to help in this, their greatest hour of need. The idea that you would be plotting a decapitation strike, I can't, you know, and again, maybe there's an imminent threat, but that I don't believe it. I just can't put myself in the head of someone who would think that way.
Except that Donald Trump always needs to change the narrative, doesn't he? If the plot is going in the wrong direction, he has to figure out a way to write a different script.
Right.
Which, by the way, is among the scarier things. What will he do? He's just simply not going to ride the economy and ride the pandemic, down to November. He's going to do whatever he can to change the subject, find somebody else to blame, or whatever. He's the master of distraction.
But that goes back to your story about, you know, easier times. That, you know, when most people are focused on their private lives, as they were in 27, 2018, and you're only and TV is only talking, or political events are talking to, you know, a relatively small group of people who are basically hobbyists, you know, then you can change the narrative. The president has enormous power that way. You are not but when people are in their houses, unable to meet their bills because they have lost their jobs and they have no idea when the kids will go back to school and when they will go back to work. You can't make them think about something else. Maybe tigers, maybe adorable tigers, but nothing else other than an adorable baby tiger will take their minds off. The kids aren't in school and I don't have a job and my 401k is gone. And the more Donald Trump tries that, the more he's going to look feeble, because the story is the story. The truly great presidents, I think the Roosevelts and the Lincolns and the Washingtons would all echo what Lincoln said: I don't pretend to have controlled events, but freely confess that events have controlled me. Mm-hmm. Because the great presidents face events that are so extreme. Well, now we face events that are it's not as terrible as the Civil War. It's not as terrible as the Depression, World War II, but it's you know, in the neighborhood. And that event is going to control you, and you are judged by how you meet it.
David Frum, thank you so much for your time this morning and coming back on the Bulwark Podcast. I appreciate it very much, and very much looking forward to the book.
Always so much. We'll get you a copy. Always such a pleasure to talk.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.